You are listening to the OneOfUs.net podcast network.
Welcome to the Screamcast, episode 104. I am Sean DeRigger, and as always, with me is Brad Henderson.
104?
Yeah, man. Last week was 103.
Shit.
It's now 104.
Damn, bro.
Excuse me one second while I let my dog in who's scratching at the door. Hold on.
Man, right off the bat.
What's up, bitch?
All right, and we're leaving all that in. Welcome to the podcast, everybody. Today, pretty excited about today. We're going to be talking the American Horror Project, the box set released by Arrow Video. I'm going to be talking about that with Stephen Thrower, who is the co-curator of that set. He's also the author of Nightmare USA. So you should check that book out if you haven't yet. But first, before we get into all that, let's jump into what's on our doorstep.
Holy cow, I almost forgot.
We'll get the door.
Pizza.
Snap.
Mm-hmm. What's up, man?
Nothing much.
Arrived on your doorstep.
I don't even know. I've watched a lot. Some stuff I can talk about. Some stuff I can't.
Of course.
Let's see here. Man, I really want to talk about certain things. All right. So I'll just start with stuff that I can talk about.
Okay.
I watched the Criterion release of Easy Rider, which I saw when I was younger. I would say early teens, maybe about 14, 15 years old, I was going to Blockbuster and like rent an Academy Award winning movies because I wanted to be that film person. And I was right. I was like, man, I can't stay away from the horror section. Like I kept going back. But anyway, so I rented things off and on. Certain things stuck with me hard. You know, like Harold and Maude and things like that. You know, Year of the Dragon. I know that's not really Academy Award winner, but Year of the Dragon really got me. You know, stuff like Stand By Me.
Mm-hmm.
I was discovering these movies on by myself because, I mean, when I was in early teens, I would say 13, 14 years old, I didn't really have resources. I mean, the internet was there, but not like it is today where, you know, you can just, you know, a plethora of information on the internet about every movie you want that didn't exist. You know, I had, like I mentioned all the time on the show, I had an all movie guide, that would help me out, tell me movies and everything like that. So I eventually rented Easy Rider and, you know, I thought it was okay. And I was quickly dismissed it for the most part. Cause I was kind of getting in, I was expecting, you know, cause I was really into like Vanishing Point, you know, the original Gone in 60 Seconds, The Junk Man, Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry, White Lightning, stuff like that. I was really, really into, and I thought Easy Rider was going to be something like that, and it wasn't. And I didn't think it was a bad movie. I just really didn't talk about it or really think about it too much. So the Criterion released that, so I figured I'd pick it up because I really liked The American Dreamer. You know, that we spoke about from Vinegar Syndrome. I thought it was one of the best documentaries, but I guess it's a die. It's almost like a home movie. You know, one of the best things that I saw last year is still remains one of my favorites. I think about it all the time. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to watch Easy Rider again. You know, cause Criterion released it. So it's got a glorious transfer. All that, you know, they always do a bang up job. And with that mindset, I watched it thinking about American Dreamer as well. So it kind of, I think a cool triple feature would be to watch Easy Rider, American Dreamer, and then watch the last movie, which is, you know, American Dreamer's the in-betweener, you know, after Easy Rider, before last movie, during last movie of, you know, Dennis Hopper and his, you know, psychological breakdown of himself trying to make a movie as good as Easy Rider, as well known as Easy Rider is and how good it was at the time. To me, I enjoyed Easy Rider because it feels – I enjoyed in the aspect of Dennis Hopper and knowing the American Dreamer and knowing last movie now where I am in life watching films and enjoying it on another level of being almost experimental. I honestly think if Easy Rider came out today, it would not be looked at twice. Because it very much is an experimental film of drugs. And, dude, they're all fucking on drugs during this movie. It's way too obvious. You know, I don't even really think there's a script to the film. It's just cruising along, talking about dope and money.
Yep.
But I really enjoyed it because I'm thinking of the American Dreamer. I don't know. I think – little old me, when I saw it, I was expecting something else. I didn't get it. But knowing what I know now and kind of, you know, being fascinated with Dennis Hopper at this point, especially during that time frame of him making those movies, I really, really dug Easy Rider. But I honestly think before you watch Easy Rider, if you've never seen it, you need to watch Vinegar Syndrome's release of American Dreamer. And that's just not a plug for them because, I mean, I've talked about American Dreamer a few times. But I think watching all three, like a triple feature of all those, I think that's almost an experience rather than just watching some movies or cinema. I think that's a really detailed and in-depth look of Dennis Hopper and his filmmaking career. So highly suggest you pick it up. You know, just it looks great and it's got a great soundtrack. Peter Fonda steals the movie, basically. I don't even know, like, Dennis Hopper's not even recognized to me in that movie. It's all about Peter Fonda, and then of course when they meet up with Jack Nicholson. It's awesome. Like, I gave a 5 out of 5, but on a level of almost an experience of watching a movie, not the movie itself. That makes sense.
I think so.
Hopefully it makes sense.
Well, Easy Rider is just such a strange film. It's not really.
It's very weird. Like,
really not a huge plot. It's just, you know, you're hanging out with these guys on the bike as these on their motorcycles going across country or wherever, just doing drugs and.
Yeah, but I agree with you. Like the last few minutes of that movie when they're in like having like the graveyard psychedelic flashbacks and shit like that, the movie's really fucking bizarre.
Yeah.
So it was kind of cool to, you know, think about how well that movie was received, but I think everybody was on drugs that watched
it. Yeah.
Definitely right up my alley. And it's weird coming from me because I don't know if we ever talked about this on the show, but I've only smoked pot once in my life and I've never done any other drug. So I find it fascinating when I see it like that.
Yeah. I've only tried it like 3 times, and those 3 times, I basically just laughed a little bit and then fell asleep.
People are probably thinking, "What, Brad? You sound like a fucking crazy maniac. You don't do drugs?" No, I don't. So next up, I love this series so much. It was The Maze Runner. I talked about it a little bit last night on Twitter. I finally got around to watching Maze Runner: The Scorch Trials. When I very first saw Maze Runner earlier last year, I fucking loved it. It felt like I was watching a movie from my childhood that I missed. Very kind of straight out of the 80s. The action sequences were very much like that. It just felt like I was watching – I say No Escape meets Lord of the Flies. That's what these movies feels like to me. But I loved Maze Runner. I finally got around to watching Scorch Trials. I missed it at the theater. I picked it up when it came out on Blu-ray, and I just haven't really gotten around to it, and Willow wanted to watch it. Fucking fantastic. Still the same. It went up a notch with the action. It's a fucking zombie movie. Like, fucking zombies throughout the movie. Like, there's they're infected with this thing called the Flare. But they're fucking zombies. Like, they're on the run from these creatures for a good portion of the movie, meeting up with, I mean, it's like, it's like No Escape meets like Road Warrior meets, you know, Lord of the Flies meets, you know, kind of a John Carpenter-ish like Escape from New York, L.A., more or less L.A. than anything, because it kind of has – but Maze Runner is like the 80s and Scorch Trial is more like the 90s, like in cinema for for us. And it's weird because these young adult novels are being made into movies like, you know, all the time.
Yeah, it's so hard to know which ones are good now. I mean, you know.
Well, most of them are garbage. And yeah. I'm sorry if anybody likes it.
Well, I'm not a fan of Hunger Games at all.
I really don't care for those movies just because they feel bland. There's not really – it doesn't feel like there's characters established or, you know, there's no character dynamics it feels in those films. And it's not, you know, kind of – putting down the film, I think it's more or less to relate to the audience, not because the audience is stupid, but it's written from a young adult perspective
in a way. They're four kids. Yeah, you got to keep
right. You got to stay true to the source material. Apparently, the Scorch Trials. I haven't read the books, but apparently, from people I spoke to about it from last night, it doesn't follow the book all that much. It kind of does its own thing, but that's neither here or there. It's very, I mean, this film seems like it shouldn't be something that I would like. It doesn't seem like it's geared towards me at all, but I think Wes Ball, the director of these films, really has kind of affinity for, action cinema from the 80s and 90s. Cause that's the vibe I get. All these fucking practical effects in the film, other than for maybe a couple sequences. But, you know, the Grievers look great in the first film. The zombies look great. There's some Vine zombies that remind me of I Am Legend a little bit that come out. But it's easily dismissed because it happens so quickly. But great characters. The camaraderie with the cast, the young kids, is great. Barry Pepper's in it, which is super weird because I haven't seen Barry Pepper since like Battlefield Earth days. but it's all around. Both of these films are great, and I can't wait until that third one comes out. Huh. And Wes Ball is directing it. I can't recommend these movies enough because, as far as action cinema goes, this is something that feels special because it has that nostalgia. For older people, I say that and I'm fucking 30, but I think for people that grew up watching action movie in the 90s and loves those types of films, loves films from the 80s, I think this is truly something special for us because he's making these films and he's not turning to the camera and being like, hey, I really like these old movies. Wink, wink. Look at me. Look at me. It's nothing like that. These movies stand on their own. And I've interacted with people when I liked Maze Runner and I like this. I had people say I didn't get that vibe at all. And I've had other people say, yes, it truly is like kind of this 90s, 80s John Carpenter, No Escape, Lord of the Flies feel. So I'm really digging those movies, and I hope that, you know, they're doing well because obviously the kids and teenagers like them, but I really hope adults give it a chance because I think these are really great movies. I know they are, and I don't think anything. I know they're really great movies and something for everybody to enjoy.
Well, yeah, I really like the first one. I haven't watched Scorch Trials yet.
I think Scorch Trials is better than Maze Runner.
Huh.
And I really, really fucking love Maze Runner. So next up we have Regression, which is the new I guess it came out last year, but I think it finally hit Blu-ray with Ethan Hawke and Emma Watson. Making it spoiler-free. it is about a man that comes into a police station who is wanted because of the abuse, a sexual abuse of his teenage daughter, but can't remember anything. So they bring in a psychiatrist to do kind of hypnosis. To hypnotize him to put him back into that period of that event. Ethan Hawke is one of the main detectives on the case, and they put him in that situation of revisiting that night, and it kind of unfolds from there. I will say it's up my alley in the sense of the content, which has to deal with cults and Satan. So that should be enough to turn you on nice. To where this film goes. However, I was not a fan of the movie because of what it developed into. So watch it for yourselves, and anybody that likes it, let me know how you felt about the ending, because I was not on board. I thought the film was pretty scary, kind of terrifying with the cult aspect. The thing is with me, I'm super biased. As soon as you say there's a cult or I see an upside down cross, I'm automatically going to give the movie a 10. Like, it starts off at 10, like regression, like the title pops up and then the eye in regression slowly turns into an upside down cross. And I just pause it and I start applauding in my living room. I'm like, all right, we're starting off at a 10. Let's just go up. And it kept it going up. And then it's one of those things that can make or break a movie, and it broke it for me.
Yeah.
And it's not that it didn't make sense. It's just something I didn't want to see, but I think it's a cool plot device. I just didn't like it for this movie. And I know that the movie was made because of that plot device, but, you know, the only other thing I could say is that, nope, I'm not going to say it. So, let me know what you think.
I saw a few people pick this up on Tuesday.
Yeah, apparently it's Anchor Bay, so it's probably like $10.
I think it was like $14.99 or $12.99 or something like that.
It's $10 on Vudu, so I rented it for like $3.99. Fucking Ethan Hawke is like what a horror actor veteran now.
I know, man.
I mean, I don't think he gets enough credit. I mean, he is in Sinister, Daybreakers. He was in this. He was in he's in The Purge, which is very, you know, horror-ish. That's funny saying that.
Whenever I try to use like my voice thing on my phone to say horror, it spells out horror. So Siri thinks I'm ordering horrors.
Ooh,
what?
Siri might put you in jail. but yeah, Ethan Hawke. Yeah, I think he's finally kind of coming around in the sense of, I feel like he's doing what he wants, which
he's getting good work. Like he's not like Nicolas Caging it up. You know what I mean? Or he's just taking whatever. He's taking interesting projects for sure.
Yeah, I like him. I mean, everything from, he's did like The Purge, and then he did Boyhood, and then he did like, you know, some kind of low budget films. And
Before Sunset Trilogy thing, he wrapped that up.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, he does a lot of independent cinema, which I dig. He's in Ty West's In the Valley of Violence, aka John Wick in the West. So, I mean, literally is John Wick. Fucking, they kill his dog and he goes on a killing rampage. Like, watching it, I'm like, I know that Ty West, like, had that idea, but you think that you'd watch a movie, I mean, fucking, what, Luc Besson wrote Lockout, and it's basically a mirrored image of fucking Escape from New York? Like,
yeah,
you
but
know.
It's awesome.
Yeah, awesome enough that he got sued by John Carpenter because of it.
That's bullshit.
And won.
That's
dude,
crazy.
It's a fucking ripoff. Like, it totally is almost like.
But how many movies are there that are direct homages to older movies? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, but
look at Roger Corman. Like, Roger Corman should have been sued like crazy.
No, because Roger Corman ripped himself off more than anything, but. In the sense of, you know, kind of using exact plot devices and almost beat by beat of, I mean, In the Valley of Violence doesn't do that because obviously it's the West, but I mean, using that plot device that's so simple. Like, when you think about John Wick, you're like, hey, what's John Wick about? This guy's an assassin, they kill his dog, and he goes on a killing rampage. I would have fucking laughed.
But there's more to the dog in John Wick.
Right, but that's the plot.
There's a reason why he holds that dog.
No, I understand, but that's the plot.
Right.
The plot is they kill a guy's dog, and he goes on a killing rampage.
Yeah.
And when he said, like, the thing is, Keanu Reeves is, like, your brother. When you watch his movies, you're just like, you think, you hear Keanu Reeves, and you're like, I fucking like that guy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's no one, if anybody says anything bad about Keanu Reeves, I just fucking slap him in the face. I'm like, you don't understand, like, how cool this fucking guy is. Like, you know, I've been there when he's at these festivals. He's just fucking talks to people. Like, he loves movies. He just wants to fucking make cool movies. He just wants to hang out. You know, his movies feel like you're hanging out with him.
Yeah.
So it works, because if you put anybody else in that movie, I don't think it would have worked.
Oh, no.
I think that movie was made for that Keanu Reeves character. Like, the badass, you know, Point Break, fucking Bill and Ted. You know, he's just a fun-loving guy. But anyways, we got off really subjective. But, yeah, watch Regression. Let me know what you think, if you kind of feel the same way. That's pretty much all I can talk about.
All right.
Hopefully I can talk about stuff later on when movies get distribution.
Sounds good, man.
Because you really can't, like, the thing is, you're not, it's kind of, the thing is that, you know, you see these movies that you don't like. And this is my kind of beef with festivals, is that, you know, I watch a movie to help out with a festival or something. Hey, watch this, Brad. Doesn't have distribution. Probably only a handful of people have seen it. I have no right to say that movie is bad or not good or it didn't pique my interest.
Right.
So for the most part, I just keep my mouth shut, because I never want to, you know, throw a monkey wrench in. Because the thing is, companies do listen. They use Twitter. They click on, you know, hashtags. That helps films get distribution. So if you're at a festival and you are just, like, tweeting and shitting on a movie, stop.
Yeah, you gotta, like, get these movies have to at least be given
it
a chance to be,
yeah,
in the world.
Someone's gonna like it.
You know?
Someone's gonna like it. You know, don't almost, like, fucking disable a movie because, you know, from going anywhere. Because I've seen it happen. I mean, there's movies that I saw years ago that have never, ever made distribution.
Yeah.
You know, and it's kind of, you know, it's kind of sad. I think on the one show with Pete Toombs, I mentioned a movie, The Last Screening. You can't fucking find that anywhere. There's a French DVD that costs like $50 in order to get. Movie, unless you download it illegally, but, like, that film will never, like, unless I told Pete to look into it. Hopefully they release it. But, you know, you have a movie that's never going to be seen pretty much by American audiences.
Yeah.
It didn't do very well at festivals. And it's a great movie, but no one's going to fucking see it. The same thing happened with, I think, the same show we talked about, Masks, a German giallo. You'll never see that movie. It came out like 2011. Huh. 2016. Masks is not released in the U.S.
Yeah.
And there's thousands of movies like that. There's even movies that have never been released anywhere. Most of them are found footage. I'm not gonna lie. I've seen some found footage movies. But, you know, the thing is that what the problem, another problem is with some of these companies, or not companies, but some of these filmmakers, is that they make a movie and they want, you know, Magnet to pick it up or some bigger company to put it in stores. And frankly, the movie isn't good enough. So they pass on all the small guys because they offer such a low amount. But then that company passes, and then you're out of luck because no one wants it. That's exactly what happens to these guys. So that's the reason why you see so many found footage movies, is because, honestly, it didn't cost them that much, and they're going to sell to the first person that probably offers them anything.
Yeah.
You know, and every once in a while you get a good one. Most of the time you get a shitty one. Most of the time.
Right on. All right, I'm going to jump into my movies.
What you got, Sean?
And then we get Steven Thrower on the show. The first thing I want to talk about is, I don't think I've talked about this yet. Mill Creek released it, My Boyfriend's Back. Have I talked about that yet? I talked about my science project from Mill Creek.
Yeah, we didn't talk about All My right. Boyfriend's Back. I was trying to get Bob Babylon.
Bob Babylon. And this was my, I thought I'd seen it before, but I guess I hadn't. And this is 1993 flick. Feels very much like an 80s flick.
Oh, it's like, yeah.
It's great.
So
it's,
does Parents.
Yeah.
Parents is made in the 90s, I believe.
Yep, totally. It's great. It has that feel of an 80s movie. I think it takes place in the 80s. Of course, the main character played by, was it Johnny? Played by Andrew Lowry. Who? What else has he been in? He seems super familiar. He's really good in this.
Andrew Lowry.
I don't know what the hell he's been in. He like nothing much, I guess.
What's he look like now? What's he look like?
That's the
guy that's in Buffy the Vampire Slayer. That is Buffy's boyfriend's friend. Who, when she leans over the car, he goes, "Hey man, can I borrow her?" And he's like, "Dude, hands off."
Maybe
that's the guy that's in My Boyfriend's Back. Yeah, he's in.
He's not in that much as far as like Letterboxd doesn't really show him in that much.
He's
Color
in,
of Night and Final
Color,
Charm.
The Bruce Willis movie.
Yeah, he plays Bruce Willis's dad.
He's in School Ties. He's in School Ties. It's the movie I was thinking about.
Really?
But no, I think this was like his big break. You know. It didn't hit.
He's really funny. He plays this kind of a loner type guy. Really likes this girl. He's liked her since he was a kid. Played by Tracy Lynn, who's super cute.
Let's talk about Tracy Lynn, class of 1999.
Mm-hmm,
hello.
Mm-hmm.
Fucking Fright Night 2.
Yeah. But so he creates this elaborate plan with his friend who has like a Shia LaBeouf vibe. Danny Zorn. I think it's the only movie he's ever been in. I don't know, but he looks like Shia LaBeouf, like a weird, like bizarro world Shia LaBeouf. They hatch this plan where his friend's going to act like he's robbing the convenience store where she works. Of course, Johnny's going to come in and save the day, ask her to prom, live happily ever after. Unfortunately, a real robber comes in and Johnny gets shot and basically turns into a zombie. So it's very lighthearted. You know, he's turning into a zombie. And but everyone seems to be kind of okay with it, which is kind of peculiar and funny. So it sets up a lot of things, a lot of humor. But it was a really good movie, man. Like, I had a lot of fun watching it.
Oh, yeah, it's great. I think Bob Babylon has a really good grab on making fun kind of almost like a dream state of movies, especially like kind of with Parents, My Boyfriend's Back. They both had kind of have that same like, I can't think of the name, but just kind of like I can't think of the word I'm trying to say. Kind of a suburban like feel, you know, suburbia.
Yeah. Like, he does. I mean, it's lighter for sure. It feels lighter, but it's very fun.
Yeah.
And what I liked, like, he does a lot of like comic book transitions. So it starts off like with comic book pages and things like that. And transitions into scenes, just really fun. Good flick. It was fun to discover that. It's one of those I swear that I saw in the video store and never got around to watching.
Dude, it's great. I mean, the cast in it too. I mean, Bob Babylon can get a good cast because he's, you know, been a writer in Hollywood for many years and an actor. But I mean, fucking, what is it? Matthew Fox is in that movie.
Yeah. Philip Seymour Hoffman's in it.
Philip Seymour Hoffman, yeah. Matthew McConaughey is in that movie.
Is McConaughey in that?
Yeah, he's like one of the friends.
Oh, he's like super small part, right?
Yeah. He just has a small part. Cloris Leachman, who just like turned fucking 90. And then Paul Dooley, who's a familiar face, you know, kind of always plays a gangster, kind of a doofus. But yeah, and Tracy Lynn.
Yeah.
I mean, fucking class of 1999. Did we ever talk about class of 1999 on the show?
No, I don't know. Have we?
I don't know. But she's in this.
Anyways, it's Mill Creek, so it's fairly cheap, bare bones release. I don't know if this is streaming anywhere or not, so it'd be worth it to pick it up if you're a fan of these types of movies. I think it's pretty damn cheap. I'm trying to look here. $5.89. No brainer.
Mill Creek. Yeah, it's Mill Creek.
Buy that shit. It looks great too.
Looks Which I just got there. One of my goals for 2016 was to watch Miami Vice. Well, Mill Creek's re-releasing Miami Vice on DVD, so I'll be watching those shortly. I can't wait.
Hell yeah. Anyway, I would, if you're a fan of these types of comedy, this is comedy done right. It's really great story. It's very story driven, very fun, very light, but, I just had a blast with it. And for $5.89, you can't go wrong. So buy that shit.
I agree, Sean.
To another flick. I finally got around to watching my FX2 Blu-ray.
Oh, yeah.
Put out by Kino Lorber. They put out FX and FX2. And I watched this movie like crazy as a kid. I had the VHS, and I think I wore the VHS out. It's crazy the kinds of movies you kind of, you know, gravitate towards as a kid. And I saw this before the first FX. And I always love the opening because it opens up with like this movie within a movie type thing where there's like this transvestite robot killing machine scene. And it's just fantastic, and the movie's great as well. So I think I like this one more than the first FX.
I think they're both pretty solid.
They're both fantastic. So it looks great, sounds great, and so if you're
probably
a fan of
fairly
that,
fairly cheap too,
huh?
Fairly cheap too, probably.
Yeah, I think I was waiting for this to get on sale. There's a Kino Lorber sale. That's like $14 or something.
Yeah,
I don't know. But yeah, I'm a huge fan of that movie, and it was really fun revisiting, for sure. So another movie that, was this in the 80s or 90s? 1991, but feels very, very late 80s.
Yeah. I think the first one was in the 80s, yeah. Second one was in the 90s.
And dude, Brian Dennehy, I mean, that man is awesome. I love when he first shows up in the movie, he's like, you know, his first line is like, you know, get off my roof and get in the fucking car.
Friend and he's a shit.
Yeah.
He's very intimidating too.
Yeah.
Extremely intimidating.
All right. And finally, of course, Deadpool came out this week, and I never made it to the theater to watch Deadpool. So I had my first time watch of Deadpool at my house on Blu-ray, and I had a blast.
Yeah, it's fun, man.
Super fun. I was expecting it to be a little bit cheesy, but for me, like, all the humor just hit. I was cracking up. My wife enjoyed it, which was fun. That's fun when we both can enjoy a movie.
It's one of those movies that I think, as for a person that doesn't really care for the comic book world, I mean, the movies are fun, whatever, most of them, some of them.
Mm-hmm.
But kind of getting burnout on everything, I think that Deadpool is refreshing because it knows it's a comic book movie, and I think that's why it works.
Totally. Yep. It's almost in a sense skewering the whole comic book movie sensibility. Yeah. I love the jabs that they take at Fox. Fox has big balls to release a movie like this and let the scriptwriters poke fun at them and their franchises.
I was surprised even like of, you know, the characters breaking that wall and acknowledging that Wolverine exists and, kind of fucked that movie and what happened. and it's cool that Ryan Reynolds stuck with that character too. Cause I mean, he was Deadpool in the Wolverine movie.
Yeah. That movie almost could have killed any future Deadpool stuff. It was a shame because we knew how much at the time I knew how much Ryan Reynolds was a fan, and he'd been talking it up, and hearing him being cast as Wade Wilson in that Wolverine movie got a lot of people excited.
Yeah, I remember even Robert Rodriguez was attached to this movie at some point. You know,
this is great, man. I loved it, man. I think the effects were great. I think that even though there's some obvious CG, I think it worked in with
Colossus
the tone.
Colossus looks
of
great.
The film. Colossus looks fantastic. The highway fight scene that basically takes up almost the first half of the film, like in between flashbacks and stuff, is just awesome. One of my favorite kind of action scenes I've seen in a long time. I love how it's gory, but not gory for gore's sake. You know, the balance of everything, even the raunchy humor, is just fantastic. Like, they could have gone totally overboard, like a Ryan Reynolds sex comedy. They reined a lot of that in. It's still gleefully R-rated, but I had a lot of fun, man. I don't know.
The question is that I have about this movie is, how the fuck did Tim Miller, the guy that directed it, do this fucking movie?
I don't know,
man. His
first
movie ever.
Yeah,
and he's directing a big comic book movie.
He's in animation, right?
Yeah, I know. I think that's his past. I'm not 100% sure what he did, but I know this is his directorial debut as a feature.
Yeah, it's a...
And, you know, how cool is that? That you have a first-time gig, you make a rated R Deadpool movie, and you kill the box office.
He did a fantastic job. He knocked it out of the park. He did some animation stuff or whatever in Scott Pilgrim. That's all I know. Everything else is, like, his filmography is like zero. Like, he's done some visual effects, like, he's done some writing, but not a lot. So he set up his career through this film, and it does not feel like a debut at all.
No, it's one of those things that it's so off the wall. And the cool thing is, it doesn't relate to any of the comic book movies. Like, that exists now.
It kind of doesn't. Like, they use the same X-Men mansion, talking about the X-Men, but they make...
Right, but it feels like it's completely by itself in its own world, which is super cool.
Yep. Yeah, it's great. Had a lot of fun with it, so I would recommend Deadpool. And that's it, man. That's all I got.
Cool. Yeah, that's all I have, too.
Awesome. All right, well, let's... It was kind of a light news week and everything, and so I think we're going to skip the news this week. We'll catch back up with Josh.
But everybody loves the news.
I know, but I want to get to Stephen Thrower.
We're going to lose, like...
There was, like, two releases.
We're going to lose two listeners.
They'll be fine. You guys will be fine. Next week, Josh will be back with a kick-ass news segment, and... But yeah, let's get into this interview here with Stephen Thrower, and let's talk about American Horror Project.
Something happened in Janie's room while you were gone.
Oh?
All right, today we have the pleasure to talk to Stephen Thrower. He's the co-curator of all the films, the three films so far in the American Horror Project. So, Stephen, thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
You're welcome.
So, I guess first thing we would want to know is, like, how did you become involved with this project? You're the co-curator. How does that work with you coming in on this project here?
It kind of started because, well, I'd worked with Arrow quite a bit before on some of their other releases. I'd done sleeve notes for Lucio Fulci releases that they'd done, and a variety of other things like John Russo's Midnight and the Spanish film Pieces, various films like that. As a result of that, I got into a few conversations with them about the possibility of future releases. The idea for an American exploitation package kind of came about, mainly from Francesco to begin with, at Arrow. It was just a desire that they had to do something along those lines. And I know that they were very inspired by my book, by Nightmare USA, which came out, you know, in about 2007, 2008, which is a book that's dedicated to low-budget exploitation movies, kind of independent movies made away from Hollywood, often quite regional productions, small productions. There was they were interested in doing something that kind of was drawing on the experience I'd had in writing that book. And obviously, because at the time I wrote that, quite a few of those films were relatively unknown, it seemed like a good opportunity to put something together that would be kind of a bit more off the beaten track, where the films themselves might be things that pass people by. In a few cases, maybe very obscure. In other cases, just films that maybe we felt hadn't had a really good bite of the cherry. So that's kind of the inception for the project.
Awesome. Well, we'll go through and we'll talk about each of these films here and your involvement and your thoughts on the films. But first of all, were these three that were chosen, were they in your book, Nightmare USA?
Yeah. Okay. All three of them were covered in the book. Cool. Malatesta was an instance where actually Malatesta I found relatively late on in the writing process. I think I was within about 6 months of completing the book, which took about 5 years altogether. I found the film had a DVD release that was coordinated by the filmmaker himself. That came to my attention. It was a movie title that had been on a list of must find out more about this kind of movies. But for years, all that anyone knew was that it had apparently played a few dates in the southern states. It was a strange title on a list of titles to explore. Fortunately, the filmmaker himself put out coordinated a DVD release, which meant that just as I was coming to the end of writing Nightmare USA, I happened upon it and thought, oh my goodness, this is really actually pretty far out. So I didn't write a whole chapter about Malatesta in the book. I mean, the structure of Nightmare USA is that the majority of the book is made of fairly substantial, you know, 20-page sort of features on a particular filmmaker or sometimes just a particular film. Because I came across Malatesta, as I say, quite late on, I wrote a review of it and then managed to contact Christopher and interviewed him and also contacted the guys that did the effects on the film and talked to them a bit. So I ended up with, I think, about 2 pages of coverage in Nightmare USA. But still, it was the most extensive coverage the film had received. It was really great to make contact with Christopher. And when it came time to putting together the box set, then we were looking at films that had not already, in some cases, we were really hoping to find films that hadn't had any kind of major digital release at all. Malatesta had never been out on video, so it had passed the video era by, and you know, it never kind of had that sort of exposure. The DVD release that Christopher coordinated was a relatively obscure one. It wasn't a big run. So it seemed ideal. It was a, you know, strange, unusual movie that maybe a lot of people hadn't seen, which I honestly thought they ought to see, and it was a lot more interesting than it, you know, than it was than its low profile might indicate.
Mm-hmm. It definitely is a strange little film. And I know a lot of people, when I was kind of reading reviews online, or just kind of people in these Facebook groups I'm in, and people talking about it online, were curious on why the film would be in the set, because they were favorable on the other two films, but this one was such an oddity that some people had issues with it being so odd. But I love the craziness of this film. When did you first end up seeing the film in its entirety? Was it some in research for the book? Or
it was during research for the book. So it was a film that I came across whilst writing the book. In some cases with Nightmare USA, I was writing about films that I'd always had a passion for,
okay,
that had popped up on video and then disappeared again, but I'd always, you know, held a bit of a torch for them. And in other cases, there were films which, as I learned more and researched more, I found films that I wasn't even aware of when I began, and that was one of them. As far as response to the film goes, and in terms of the way it perhaps divides audiences, the whole nature of this project is that it's not going to please everybody all of the time. That's just not possible. If you want a surefire 100% audience response, then what are you going to do? Just, you know, put out umpteen versions of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. You know, everybody loves that film. You can tick that box and say, hey, everybody loved it. Yeah. I love it. It's a masterpiece. Mm-hmm. But if you want to try and tread some fresh ground, you know, sort of like put some footprints in the snow that haven't been there before. Then sometimes you have to take a chance on movies that aren't necessarily going to have 100% across the board appeal. As long as I would say, as long as half or so of the people who bought the box set got something out of the film, then I think the box set and the principle of the collection is working just fine. Mm-hmm. Again, you know, there are three films in there. You're not going to like all of them. The chances are that one of them is going to fall short in relation to the others in a person's opinion, you know.
Yeah. Well, they're all such different films, I think, in a set. And like yeah. I said, this one is like just a strange little nightmare of a film that I loved. I mean, I love things that are a little crazier. And this thing just was hitting all the right check boxes yeah. for me on just how, you know, I mean, it's super low budget. I mean, there's obviously, you know, I joked around online when I was watching this, you know, what was the tinfoil budget, you know, for this film?
That's right. One of the things I really like about it is it is an amateur production. Yeah. And I use that word admiringly, not critically. It's a film made by people with no previous experience in filmmaking mm-hmm. who scraped some money together, got the various talents of their friends together and said, let's just do it. And it doesn't matter really if we're constantly going to judge people's efforts by the benchmark created by, you know, the classics, mm-hmm. then to me that seems like a really unsatisfying way of approaching cinema, because you're always wandering around feeling eternally disappointed that, you know, this isn't the great movie that, I don't know, whatever your favorite would be, you know. I mean, if you're running around with The Exorcist and The Omen in your head as great films, which I don't personally, but if that's your benchmark for great horror cinema, then chances are you're not going to like any of the films in this set, right. Frank. You know?
Yeah, no, I agree with that wholeheartedly. Yeah, I think this is something, because just knowing, because the carnival that's in Carnival Blood actually exists too.
That's right.
And that on itself is pretty nightmarish. I would say. So I don't know. When I very first saw this, it felt like, you know, kind of even shot on video horror, like how cheesy and kind of low budget it was. But it also, being that everything's kind of, you know, real, it does have that nightmarish quality. Odd movie.
One of the things I really like about regional horror cinema, the kinds of films that I was covering in Nightmare USA, one of the great appeals for me was films that had a sense of place. I mean, it might not be top of the list of things that people want from a horror movie. You know, obviously violence, shock, horror, you know, sort of death, preferably as much as possible. But, I mean, one of the things on my list, certainly, is a sense of place, a sense of the environment that the film is made. I enjoy these kinds of movies because they're made in, it's made in a real decrepit, rundown funfair. I mean, as a horror fan, if you can't get a kick out of walking around a decrepit, rundown fairground off season, I don't know where you're coming from. I mean, sort of like that seems to me to be the kind of thing that horror fans do on their vacations for fun, you know? And this is the kind of thing that this movie taps into. It might not be the greatest story ever told. It might be a little on the rough and ready side. At the same time, you feel like you're kind of there in these strange, out-of-the-way places, and they've got an atmosphere that, if you're receptive and you tune into it, is as much of a kick to me as the more obvious kind of pleasures of, you know, violence and sex and violence, you know, which I adore. But location and the pleasures of an eerie location seem to me to be just as valid and interesting as anything else.
Well, the entrance of I can't pronounce his name. Is it Hervé?
Hervé, yeah.
Villachaise. Mm-hmm. I've always loved whenever he shows up in things, and I mean, I was a huge fan as a kid of Fantasy Island, so you know, seeing him show up here was fantastic as the character of Bobo. did the director have any stories on how they brought him in or got him to be a part of the project?
I think that I can't remember, to be honest, what the situation was with him. I mean, he was certainly one of the only, you know, professional, you know, previously exposed actors that were working on the film. I think Christopher goes into it in a little bit more detail on the actual commentary mm-hmm. track. But, yeah, I mean, he's a you know, he's a unique talent and an odd character among several odd characters in the film. I mean, there's one of the people I really like in that movie is William Preston, who's the kind of janitor around the fairground, who's he's got a kind of a wandering eye, you know, he's got that kind of condition where the eyeballs don't point in the same direction, and a great sort of carnival face, you know, the sort of person that would, you know, sort of like put the wind up kids if he kind of lurched around the corner at a sort of a fairground, you know, and he's playing, I mean, you know, he's playing it up for all it's worth. He obviously relishes playing that role. It's not, you know, I don't want to get into that question. It's not really necessary, but you know, the whole question of whether or not it's exploitative. He's just a cool, crazy looking guy. And he, you know, he is actually pretty alarming in the film. And there's points when he grabs hold of people or chases one of the unfortunate female characters around in the film that actually has that little frisson of real scares to it, you know, so.
Brad, did you see any other actors in here that you're familiar with from other films?
I can't really remember. I mean, it was, I want to say like faces wise, but like not so much like notable names where I actually knew it. It's just that I've seen them pop up before, but I don't think, yeah, like William Preston was definitely one. Cause he plays, He plays what's his name? It's like something weird, right?
Sticker.
Okay, yeah.
That's right. Yeah. That's him.
But no, that's I can't. No, not that I would say like, hey, this is person notable, other than, you know, Fantasy Island guy.
I think, I mean, even Hervé Villechaize, I think was. I think his TV career came after this film. I think The Love Boat was after this. Oh, okay. And he was in...
This is 73, right? This movie.
That's right. Yeah. And he was in a Bond film as well, wasn't he? He was
in Man with a Golden Gun.
Yeah. Which is immediately after Malatesta. So, you know, that must have been an experience for him, you know, from the set of Malatesta's Carnival of Blood to the set of a major Bond movie, you know.
I guess Fantasy Island came later because he was in Forbidden Zone before that, and then, But I mean, of course, I'm most familiar with him through Fantasy Island. So at the time, he was relatively unknown in this relatively unknown horror film.
Well, but, I mean, one of the appeals of low budget horror films and these kind of movies made very much on the fringes of the mainstream industry is that you don't recognize a lot of the people in them.
Yeah.
You sometimes feel when you're watching mainstream movies and you see the same people popping up, the same actors, that it's a little bit like in theatre class when the same kids get hold of the costume first. You know, sort of like they're kind of hogging all the limelight. Mm-hmm. I'm sick. I don't want to see Johnny Depp playing fucking, you know, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde as if he's working his way through every single role that could possibly be of interest.
He needs to take a couple year hiatus, in my opinion.
Yeah, really. But it's the same for an awful lot of mainstream movies where obviously part of the appeal of a mainstream movie is that it taps into that desire to see stars and the repetition of seeing the same people. So it's a different game. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that low-budget movies do, one of the reasons, for instance, why the Texas Chainsaw Massacre works so well is that you don't recognize any of the people in it before. I mean, now, of course, we know them, but the first time you saw that movie, none of the faces in that film were familiar. And so you had no idea who the plot was going to favor. You didn't know, you couldn't tell. I mean, nowadays you can hazard a guess as to who's going to survive based on who's the biggest profile star in the cast, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's, I think it's more unsettling not to recognize people and to be seeing them for the first time in the story, you know, rather than
a sense of realism.
Yeah, it does. Because these are just some people, you've never met them before, but now you're looking into their, you know, you're getting a window into their unfortunate lives as they die horribly. So,
well, Malatesta, I mean, for a movie like this, you know, it's just then that's the one thing that whenever we bring up Arrow and companies like this, and Arrow especially, and even Vinegar Syndrome, is the care that gets put into these obscure films, getting these, you know, deluxe treatments, you know,
yeah.
I think Arrow is one of the few companies that it's like every release they do is a special event. They're going to put a ton of extras and things like that. Whereas a company like Scream Factory reserves that kind of thing for their, mainly for their collector's edition titles, as far as the new stuff or things like that. But Arrow seems to give each of the films that acquires the kind of Arrow touch, which is pretty great. And this is why, you know, things like this, whenever a box set or something like American Horror Project comes out, I'm always, you know, have to scrape the bottom of the barrel of my bank account to make sure I can get a copy. But I always want to make sure I can grab a copy like this.
There's a situation developing now where the mainstream, the major companies are not really putting their weight behind Blu-ray releases. You get situations where, you know, big budget movies have been put out on Blu-ray without striking a new master, you know, DVD masters kind of just bumped up to Blu-ray.
Yeah.
And quite often the Blu-rays have got a fraction of the dedication when it comes to extras that you get in the smaller releases. I think that's kind of funny in a way. It's as if the obviously the mainstream, the big companies are probably looking at streaming and Netflix and things and thinking, oh, you know, physical copies are on the way out. What's the point of expending any more on documentaries and behind the scenes stuff and the rest of it? Whereas for the collector's market and for the genre film market in particular, the fans of these kinds of movies can't get enough of the extra material. And Arrow have been very diligent, I think, in building up a really, really strong package with a reliable identity where you see that they're involved in something and think, well, you know, regardless of whether or not you happen to like the film, you can be pretty sure that they're going to push the boat out on the presentation.
Yeah. Now, were you involved with tracking down the elements for these, the vault materials, or did you turn that over to someone else?
I think with Malatesta, with all of them. I mean, I'm involved in as much as I'm trying to find the rights holders for the films. Once you find the rights holders, then obviously the question of elements comes into play. We've got a guy at Arrow called James White who is in charge of the restoration side of things, and he then liaises with whoever the rights holder is to try and find the best possible version and the best elements. Ideally, negatives or, you know, pre-print sort of elements.
Yeah.
It's not always possible. Sometimes if you want the film and you really believe that you want to do it and you could only find a 35mm print, then you go with the print and do what restoration you can. But wherever possible, we are trying to find negatives, you know, internegatives and things like that. So.
Well, all three of these look fantastic, and you know, did a hell of a bang up job. But, I mean, Arrow really doesn't disappoint on that end of the spectrum, especially with these titles alone. I was really happy that something like this was coming out, because there are a lot of American horror titles that kind of got shoved under the rug, and you visit a lot of those in your book Nightmare USA that I've been a fan of since its release. Turned me on to some films that I had no idea existed, and therefore you know that a lot of other people don't know they existed either. So it's nice to actually see three of these films out of the book. Because there was the Malatesta's Carnival of Blood was the one that I haven't seen. Because I saw The Premonition before a little, like not its an entirety, but this is the only one that I was actually looking for for a little while during my VHS days when I was in my teens trying to hunt down everything. And I remember hearing about it, and I just could never get my hands on it. So I think people need to look at that aspect, because that's what I always say is that with companies like Vinegar Syndrome and Arrow, sometimes, and like you said previously, it's just not about if the movie's good or not. It's also putting the film out there, because we're always, you know, I always say on the show that you don't want movies to die. And movies are dying all the time because no one re-releases them. Even if it has a shitty DVD release, you're still putting new life into that movie and giving it a few more years.
Yeah.
So it's nice to actually see, you know, people pick up the underdogs you know, and find something special about it, you know, because there are special things about these movies.
Yeah. I mean, just to be clear, I mean, I always, anything that I was involved in would be something that I thought was good in some way. Putting something out just to ensure its survival wouldn't be necessarily something I would do. I mean, in each of the cases with these films, they're all films that I thought had interesting and unusual qualities that deserved exposure. All I was saying earlier is that, if you measure films constantly against the very, very best, you found, you know, in mainstream terms, if you were holding Citizen Kane, if you were using Citizen Kane as a stick to beat, you know, David Cronenberg's Shivers, it was crazy, you know. But, okay, don't use what's, you know, commonly regarded as the best film ever made as a stick to beat movies that are very, very good, yeah, but not the greatest, you know. So in these cases, these are all movies that I think are made by people with integrity. They're people who are trying to make the best film they can. There's no laziness. There's nothing slapdash, even about Malatesta, which is quite an amateur production. It's not slapdash in the sense of, oh, who cares? Just stick it out and make some money. It's not like that. It's they're working as they're doing the best they can with the very limited funds they've got, and they're putting imagination ahead of everything else. And sometimes maybe the technical aspects are slightly less polished than you would expect from some of the other movies in the package, but because they've prioritized imagination, they're just going for it, and they're not letting anything as boring as budget stop them.
yeah, that's great. Let's move into the next film on the list here, and this is probably turned out to be my favorite in the set. It's The Witch Who Came from the Sea. Mm-hmm. And it's definitely, you know, the poster art is misleading because this is, you know, it looks like kind of a weird monster flick. But what it really boils down to is more of kind of a psychological horror film.
That's right.
Involving our main character played by Millie Perkins. And I just really loved the film. I loved the look of it. I actually loved that I was surprised that it wasn't just a run-of-the-mill going to be some weird monster movie or anything like that. How did you stumble across this one and make it a part of the set?
Witch Who Came from the Sea, probably in Britain, is the film in the set that had the highest profile because it was caught up in the Video Nasties controversy, which you might have heard about, which was in the early 1980s, when video first really took off, it was unregulated and there was no certification and no government control over the content of the films. And so for the first time in this country, we were getting exposed to a lot of films that had been played, you know, relatively unimpeded in America, but which were coming to Britain for the first time. And among those films, obviously horror films were a very powerful part of the early development of the video industry, because the major studios and the mainstream studios didn't get involved in video for quite a long time. They were kind of quite wary of it, and yet there was a huge demand for new product. And so low budget independent horror movies were one of the main bodies of work that kind of rose to fill that gap. And it meant that a lot of people who'd never seen the wilder or the more extreme reaches of American horror, or indeed Italian or Spanish horror, were seeing them for the first time, and it had quite a shocking effect on some people. And they something about those movies upset the people in control. And it wasn't long; it was about a period of about 3 or 4 years before control was reestablished, censorship was brought in for video, and there was a massive media campaign in the UK run by the right wing press to demonize horror and video horror. And this wretched term video nasty was coined by one of the newspapers to describe the kinds of horror films that were not decent horror films, like, you know, the Hammer films or the Frankenstein and Dracula, etc., but these nasty, cheap, dirty, filthy, cruel, mean-spirited films that they perceived, things like Last House on the Left and Cannibal Holocaust and all these films, to be. Which She Came from the Sea, you might find it surprising now looking at the film because it's nowhere near as bad as nowhere near as over the top horrific as something like Cannibal Holocaust, but it did get caught up in the legislation at the time and became a banned movie on video in the UK. It was on this famous list of, you know, whatever it was, 37 film titles or 39 film titles that were banned outright in the UK. When you actually watch the film and try and work out what it is that people were getting so upset about, I suppose really it comes down to the fact that you're dealing with a female psychotic who is in one of the film's central pivotal scenes, being the literal sort of femme castratrice. You know, she's cutting men off in their prime. And although you don't see anything as explicit as an actual dick being locked off, you have to go to, you know, Michael Hugo's Hardcore for that. But you don't see it, but certainly the emotional and psychological impact of the idea is lingered on quite substantially in that scene. Brilliantly directed, very disturbing scene. You don't see very much, but it certainly kind of gives you the shudders, you know?
Yeah.
So I can only assume that some censorious individual back in the early 80s had such a negative reaction to the whole idea of this central image, that this central scene, that they complained to the police or whatever, or the police pulled it in and a police officer was upset by it. It was all very random, the Video Nasty controversy. A lot of the films that were pulled in, when you look at them, certain films you can look at and say, well, okay, I don't agree with censorship, but I can understand why this film would have upset certain people because it's pretty extreme. And then other ones you think, what's the problem? There was a huge shortfall in terms of the explicitness of certain films compared to others. And I can't help feeling that one of the main influences on those decision making was the style of the films, the sense that they were not, the decorum of a regular mainstream drama wasn't there, that there was a sense of danger, that you didn't know where the film was going to take you, the idea that the director was, you couldn't be trusted, that you didn't know this was a dangerous person who was going to take you into very stormy emotional waters. And that's certainly the feeling you get from Witch, I think.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I can see that the sexual violence, you know, portrayed in the film and in the situations, I guess it's weird how once sex comes into play as far as censorship goes, you know, and then people start turning their heads and getting uncomfortable, and then you combine that with the violent nature of it, you know, I can see, even though it's not explicit, you know, that somebody would definitely have a problem with it at that time. It makes sense to me. But yeah, I mean, but that's what really, you know, really made me so interested in the film was, you know, just how things are portrayed.
Well, these sort of responses where you become distressed, upset, and alarmed by the content of a movie, that's what horror is. That's what it does. That's what it's there for. Wanting to censor a film on the basis that it's upsetting and distressing, a horror film on the basis that it's upsetting and distressing, is a bit like wanting to censor a comedy because it makes you laugh too much. You know, it's crazy. This is what horror is all about. And this is really one of the reasons why the horror genre will always, I think, have this element of the disreputable, of being the, you know, being the relative who's not invited to the family gatherings, you know. Even as it enters the mainstream, there's always this element of it that seems like it's trailing muddy footprints through the door. You know, there's a sort of a quality to it that isn't quite proper. And that's, we should never lose that, I think, really. That's something that should never get lost. It's part of the appeal, I think, and part of the value of the horror film, but it's not so easily assimilated. And the more polished and comfortable the experience becomes, the less valid, I think, it is. And certainly something like Witch, is going out of its way to get under your skin, to create distressing and unnerving situations. And as far as I'm concerned, that's exactly what horror films should be doing.
Yeah. And I think with that, cause I agree with you. Cause I mean, we have the Videos Nasties list, and sometimes you look at that list and you think of, you know, like this film in particular, you know, I know Visiting Hours was on that list, Night School. Some of those movies you're like, well, I guess Night School has a couple moments, but it's almost sometimes that one scene makes that film on it gets on the video's nasties list. But yeah. I think with this one, I mean, there's nothing, I guess nothing like gory. It's just the unsettling feeling that you have, even from the very opening film with the woman on the beach with her, Millie Perkins on the beach with her kids and looking over at the bodybuilders. Just even that alone, it gives this weird tone to the film that makes you uncomfortable.
I think that's a sign of the. It is a sign of the sophistication of the film. I think that.
Yeah.
It's not the unsettling and distressing qualities of the film don't just reside in a couple of splashy, violent moments like in a slasher movie.
It gives that vibe right off the bat. Yeah, like you're uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's soaked in it, and I think part of the reason for that is that the film is trying to show you the world through the eyes of a psychotic. We spend a lot of time with the Millie Perkins character, and we see the world as she's seeing it, and we listen to her account of what her memories are. Every now and again, another character will contradict those memories, but the film is so much in her world that we're sort of like that's really what the design of the film is all about, is to give you like a view of the world through the eyes of a troubled psychotic character. And it's not an easy thing to do. I mean, that's actually a fairly tricky thing to do. It requires a certain amount of psychological acuity and skill on the part of the filmmaker. And it's absolutely dependent on very, very good acting. Now, in low-budget horror and in exploitation movies, you can go a long way without good actors. You can actually get away with it. Herschel Gordon Lewis got through most of his career without a good actor, you know. It doesn't ruin The Wizard of Gore. You know, it doesn't ruin The Gruesome Twosome that there are no really good actors in the movie.
Right, yeah.
So you can get away with it. And with kind of weirdo horror films, you know, strange films that are just out to be weird, you know, you can get away with kind of shaky casting as well, you know, shaky acting. But for psychological drama, I think that's one of the areas where acting really does come to the fore, and you need somebody who knows what they're doing. And Millie Perkins, I think, is absolutely amazing in this. I think she's...
Oh, yeah, totally.
She manages to be sympathetic and frightening at the same time. It's like watching somebody that you know who's suffering from mental illness and you want to reach out and help them, but at the same time you can see that they're becoming more and more dangerous to other people and themselves. And so you're caught in this weird bind where you feel sympathy for them, but you're aware that they're doing terrible things. And the film kind of puts you in that strange, emotionally conflicted position where you feel for her. But at the same time, she's really caught up in a very destructive sort of cycle of behavior. So,
yeah, and that's exactly what you said. I think that's the sole reason why it was put on the video nasties list. And I also think a lot of people probably didn't understand, you know, because I mean, from what we're, you know, from the list that's on there in that era, and especially coming from the 70s, you know, from the 70s to the 80s, I was actually talking to a friend about this the other day. The 80s, we all had happy endings. The 70s and 60s, we had kind of really harsh endings and, you know, lead characters dying and just stuff at the end where it was just fucked up. And with The Witch, who came from the sea, it's definitely one of those films that it's fucked up. And it also, it's just not visually, it's, you know, it makes you feel weird. It makes you feel different. Like as soon as it opens up, just the tone, the music, just the beautiful cinematography, like, you know, you just know something's wrong. Just by the opening of the film, you just know that something's wrong. And I don't think a lot of filmmakers can do that.
No, absolutely. No, you're absolutely right. I mean, there's a confluence of influences and effects that are happening in that film. The music is minor key. It's very haunting. It's got this slightly neurotic quality at times when it sort of lurches into sort of kind of violent sort of spasms, but then it's this edgy, unpredictable quality that seems to mirror the psyche of the lead character. But underneath it all, there's this very melancholy tone. I'm a sucker, to be honest, for melancholy in horror films. It's kind of, you know, extreme violence and melancholia added together. That's it. I'm all over it. Something like George Romero's Martin, for instance, is a great example, you know, where you're dealing with actually a very good comparison with this film, because again, you're dealing with a sympathetic lead character who's doing terrible things. But the overall tone of the film has got a sadness to it, because the sadness comes from the sympathetic, empathetic relationship that you develop with the character. And again, comparing those two films, it's a large part of that is kind of driven by a very, very sensitive musical score as well that kind of adds that sort of melancholic element.
So. Yeah. Well, the fantastic thing about this film is, as you start kind of diving into, you know, the team that made the film, I mean, you have the cinematography we've already mentioned. I mean, that's Dean Cundey, which is
absolutely one of the greatest.
Incredible. One of the best cinematographers in the business. Then you had Matt, is it Kimber? Is that how he pronounces his last name?
Kimber, I think. Yeah, I always used to say Kimber.
Okay.
Yeah.
But he came from like, in the late 60s, early 70s, these, not really sexploitation, but like these sex documentaries.
Yeah.
He and She, Man and Wife, an educational film for married adults, African Sexualis.
Black well, kid. he's also a black exploitation director.
Yes, yeah, he did Lady Coco and the Tangerine Man,
so and the Black Six, which is a very violent biker gang movie.
Nice. So it's like
he's got very, very broad reaching and wide ranging exploitation.
Yeah. This kind of comes out of nowhere in a way. At the same time, like a different caliber. And I think Vinegar Syndrome just released Sex and Astrology recently by him too.
Oh, okay,
right.
So.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, you can almost his journey in the films he did up to The Witch Who Came from the Sea. It seems like The Witch Came from the Sea is of a different caliber. But you can also see, like, even, you know, in the sex scenes and stuff like that. Like, he obviously knew how to shoot, you know, that element. You know, I think for his background, and then the exploitation stuff kind of goes from there.
I think it's one of those examples where there's a really good team has come together.
Yeah.
Because the film would fall flat on its ass if Millie Perkins couldn't act.
Right.
So she's amazing. She was in a relationship with the writer of the film, Robert Tom. And he's at the top of his game as well. And this script apparently was very important to him. Mm. And you've got Dean Cundey shooting the film. I think Simba, maybe his previous credits didn't indicate he was going to do something quite as, you know, sort of sensitive and well crafted. No. But
working with Corman all that time, you know,
he stepped up, you know, sort of like the thing is in the presence of the right collaborators, people change and raise their game, don't they? And I think, you know, we often forget that cinema is a collaborative medium and look for, you know, to celebrate single figures like directors. And I think maybe this is one of those instances where the right constellation sort of came together and the right people found themselves in relation to each other. And everybody synergized. Everyone just clicked and they made something perhaps a little better than they would have made on their own or, you know, in a different situation.
it's just a fantastic film. I mean, all levels. I mean, this is something that I wish I would have seen sooner, even when I was in college, like taking kind of film classes and things like this. I feel like this is a film that I should have been seeing, like, alongside, you know, movies like Chinatown or whatever. Like, it's for me that it was that good. Like, I was surprised how well it was made. And I mean, has the director done any? I mean, he has movies after this, but I don't. They're all movies that I haven't seen. Brad, have you seen any of his movies through the 80s? Like,
nothing that's substantial that I can remember, at least.
I knew Matt Simba first and foremost as the director of Butterfly, which was a Piazzadora star vehicle with Stacey Keach.
Okay.
Now, Piazzadora was she's now better known through the fact that John Waters was a big fan of Piazzadora and cast her in Crybaby, is it? She's in that one. She was a sort of she was an actress who got her start in the industry through being married to a powerful and influential man in the industry. And he kind of created this sort of star vehicle for her, which Simba directed, called Butterfly. I saw that in the early 80s on video and thought it was a hoot, just a kind of a very camp sort of film with the performances and the overheated quality of this kind of sexual melodrama was quite comical, but in a fun way, not, you know, in an enjoyable way, but not a film that I ever thought, I didn't imagine I would ever revisit it. You know, it was just kind of fun to watch. So when I saw Which You Came From the Sea and realized it was made by the same guy, I had this kind of disconnect and thought, oh, these are two completely different kinds of movies, and how fascinating that he's capable of doing both. Mm-hmm. But I haven't seen the rest of his 80s. I tell a lie. I saw 100. Okay. Yes, let's not talk about that.
Well, it seems like you're right about the team, the collaboration. I mean, with the collaboration for Which You Came From the Sea, it kind of, as a filmmaker himself with that team, it seems like he peaked there with that film from what I'm looking at. I mean, I haven't seen, I mean, the only one I'm looking through, you know, only one I'm interested in, and I judge a lot of movies based on their cover, which sometimes gets me into trouble, but the poster for A Time to Die looks fantastic.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen that one. I've seen most of his blaxploitation films and some of his sex stuff, but yeah, this is he definitely hit it with this one. Mm-hmm. And he's never done anything like it that I've seen, at least.
Yeah.
And it looks like he's very I don't know, just
it's always worth reserving, I won't say judgment because we're not sitting in judgment here, but you know, I would always reserving opinion until we've seen some of the more obscure things on the list. I mean, I'm looking at his filmography here, and there are films I haven't seen because the title doesn't inspire me. Something, That Girl from Boston, might prove to be a great movie, but right, the title is grabbing me, so I haven't kind of caught up with it. And I suppose we're in the same boat, having not seen all of his films, as I was years ago when I'd seen Butterfly. You know, if someone had said to me, you will one day bend over backwards to get one of this guy's films released on home entertainment formats, I would have been amazed, you know. But because I've seen it, you know, so.
Well, but yeah, which You Came to See, definitely fantastic. It surprised me, which is always fun when something surprises me. And it's the one, if you're going to pick one film out of this whole set that I love the most, it's probably this one. But like, I mean, I love the variety so far in the American Horror Project, and we can talk a little bit after this next one about the future of this project. But let's move into The Premonition, which is another one that kind of surprised me and I loved. How did you get involved with this one? What made you decide this would be one of the first films you choose for this series?
Well, The Premonition was a film that I devoted a chapter to the career of the director of The Premonition in USA. I love the film. I love the fact that it's dealing with concerns that are kind of adult concerns, the family life, adoption, the fear that, you know, if you adopt a child, that the real parent might be sort of like planning to snatch them back again. Those sorts of emotional concerns that are more sort of, you know, parental concerns than teenage concerns. So it seemed, you were mentioning the variety of the films in the package, and that's an important part of getting this first box together, was wanting to make sure that you were offering a fairly wide selection of types of film. Malatesta is crazy. Which You Came From the Sea is psychological portraiture, and as we've just been talking about, The Premonition is a sort of it's a substantial drama about sort of like the lives of adult characters and sort of like the emotions that kind of follow on from parenthood. It seemed like it came from a completely different place to the other two, mm-hmm. And I like the fact that the box doesn't have a single theme running through it, that you're dealing with not only three different subjects, but three different approaches. I think The Premonition feels more, it's the most mainstream feeling of the films, I suppose. It feels like a drama that could possibly have been made outside of the genre, but has kind of then become soaked in the metaphysical interests of its director, because Robert Schnitzer has, for all of his life, been very interested in the paranormal. And he runs a TV station which is dedicated to, you know, the, you know, sort of like the expanded consciousness and those sorts of things. So you're dealing with a relatively four-square story to begin with, but then it kind of slightly starts to turn stranger and goes more and more off the rails until at the end you're dealing with plot developments that are kind of hanging by a thread in terms of conventional plausibility, because you've entered into a sort of a more metaphysical sort of realm where you're asked to believe that dreams and visions are ways of communicating with the dead and things like this. So.
Well, it's great. And once I saw Richard Lynch show up, you know, I knew that I would love this film once he appears on screen.
He's brilliant.
He's great. I mean, he can do so much with just a look, you know, just his face. Yeah, it adds so much depth, I think, to a character when you cast him. But
that opening scene where you see him doing sort of dance exercises in the fairground where he's working, that is such an incredibly compelling beginning. And to be honest, it plays against several of my prejudices because, you know, it's got elements of mime. And he's got clown makeup on, and those two things normally would be. I would normally walk swiftly away from that. You know, I sort of like, you know, give, you know, I don't find mimes poignant in general, and clowns can go hang as far as I'm concerned most of the time. There's something about him, and there's something about this incredibly serious, sort of focused, stern quality that he's got when he's doing these sort of moves. That kind of pulls you into the film. You think, what you immediately want to know what's going on. You want to know who he is, what what kind of a film is it that starts with this really quite almost balletic sort of piece of physical theater. You know,
you definitely can't ignore it. You definitely, you know, I mean, these days we're so distracted with our phones and everything in front of us. You know, I felt that once the film started, I kind of was, you know, sit back in my chair and put everything out, and I wanted to kind of go along for the ride with this one and just kind of figure out, you know, what was going on. And this film, I feel like you're brought through a journey with these characters, with things that go on in the film. I think I was expecting just kind of a paranormal thriller. Like, you know, I have no idea what I was expecting, you know, but
yeah,
more of a ghost story, I guess. But this had a lot more going on to it, than just that, you know. Brad, yeah. What were your thoughts on the Premonition? Was this your first time seeing it?
Oh, this is my first time actually seeing it in its entirety. I remember catching pieces of it when I was little, but this is the first time that I had seen it all on its way through. It's actually, I don't know, it's probably my favorite part, or my favorite film in the set, just because the psychological part, like, even though the witch has that, but there's like this, not psychological, but like almost like, I want to say psychosis, but it really gets into your head, especially when you have kids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it makes you think on that end of the spectrum of, you know, losing a child, trying to find a child, you know, and just kind of like this weird, because like the movie itself is very odd, how it's set up and kind of like the dream state that it's in. It's it feels like a dream, feels like a nightmare. It feels like, you know, you're in these parents' heads. I don't know. It's just so many things running together. That's the reason why I like it, because it's almost like a state of confusion sometimes for these characters. It feels like.
Yeah, it keeps kind of taking a trip out into left field, doesn't it? And it's not a straightforward linear sort of narrative. You've got this, you know, conventional couple, you know, a professional couple, loving parents of this little girl, and then you've got this unconventional couple, but with love a part of their world as well. Even though they're quite unbalanced in many ways,
right?
And the film kind of takes you between the two, and each is so, you know, the obviously the troubled characters draw your attention more, part of the structure of the film is that the more conservatively depicted characters have to embrace some of the madness of the other two in order to retrieve the situation and try and battle for the girl.
Yeah.
It's inevitable that if you set up a storyline that's based on a spaced out psychotic couple and a well-to-do professional couple living in the suburbs, well, surprise, surprise, you find yourself drawn more to the psychotic couple and their problems. and one of the things the film has to do in terms of its structure is to try and create a sort of for the suburban couple to fight back against that in narrative terms as well as in terms of our interest. Mm-hmm. And that's done by the means of the mother's visions and the tension with the father having to come to terms with the paranormal when he initially starts off as a total rationalist.
Yeah. Well, that's what's crazy about this film is you get brought into the world of the two, the crazy parents, I believe, you know, but you kind of get to know their situation first, and you kind of, in a way, can empathize with their situation. And as you start realizing what they're up to, you know, your kind of allegiance to the characters in the story starts to switch to the other ones. But I haven't seen that happen for too many times in films where a movie seems to be, you know, kind of wrestling you away from what turns out to be more of the bad guys in the film, where at first you are kind of, you get to know them first.
It's interesting that, I mean, this is a film about the family divided, or it's a film in which the family is given a mirror image of itself. And so it plays into this quality that the family has in society of being this sort of untouchable bedrock of the structure of society that, you know, we're led to believe that beyond all of the social contracts and all of the social situations, that the family is the bedrock of the psyche in many ways. And this film is creating a split or doubled family where you've got two sets of parents warring over a child. There's something intrinsically disturbing and unsettling about that setup, because it's taking one of the sanctified core elements of our identities, you know, family identity, and then creating this kind of dark mirror to it as well.
Well, it is pretty fantastic. And I recommend all three of these films. And this box set was just so fun to go through. We're at the wrap up here soon, but what's on the agenda next for? Are you curating like a part two, or is this something that Arrow definitely wants to pursue?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I can't tell you what the titles would be because it's all under wraps at the moment, but yes, there's going to be a part two. In fact, the idea is for, as many as we can do, as long as we can keep finding the materials. The big challenge really is to find adequate materials and trace, you know, the rights holders and all that kind of practical sort of legwork involved in trying to track these things down. And also, obviously, you know, there are other companies releasing things. Right. So you have to try and find something that hasn't already had other people's fingerprints all over it. And then to try and strike a balance between, obscurity and interest. Yeah. There are some films which I covered in Nightmare USA for my own personal pleasure. Which hello?
Yeah, I'm here. We dropped Brad, but we'll wrap up here with Adam. It's all good.
there are some films that I covered in Nightmare USA which aren't suitable for the Arrow treatment. they maybe just don't fit the bill quite. But if I was running my own label, I'd put them out.
Yeah.
So it's a question of finding films that fit the bill for the whole Arrow catalog that we can find the elements for and that haven't already been released in too many forms elsewhere.
Very cool. Well, we're excited for the future of that of what's coming up next. I encourage everyone to grab this set. It's one of those
that's going to be out of print soon.
It's going to be out of print soon. So we've been trying to you know, chase that down or get an episode out before it's out of print, because it's something that I believe it should be in everyone's collection for sure.
I think it's important as well. I mean, just for, you know, to kind of see these underseen and not very well-known horror films. Only a few people that really have the knowledge and really respect and want to give the time to films like this. Because, I mean, these aren't big money makers. They're not going to, you know, sell like Steven said earlier, like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Exorcist. You know, it's a different type of horror, and a horror that needs to be recognized a little bit more. Because we're too focused on kind of the slashers or, the very well-known ones, these resurgence of even films that are hitting Blu-ray that everybody knows. These films need to see the time of day too.
There's an unfortunate effect that happens in all areas of culture, actually, where the interesting fringes get cast aside, and in the same way that radio stations tend to play the same popular records by certain artists, and they don't play the slightly less popular records that are also interesting. You know? So this box set idea is a way of trying to put a flag in the ground for some of the more unusual, less frequently appreciated movies that have still got very strong qualities.
So you're saying the Arrow is kind of like the Deep Tracks of the movie industry.
Yeah.
Awesome. Steven, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. We're definitely, when the next set comes out, we'd love to talk to you about those films. So the invitation's already thrown out there to you to come back if you'd like to.
Sure.
We look forward to everything else. Is there anything else you're doing other than these Arrow sets? Any more writing or anything like that you're doing?
Nightmare USA Volume 2.
Nice.
Is in the wings, yeah.
Fantastic. Awesome. We'll look forward to that as well. Right. Thanks again for...
Is the first book still out of print?
No, I think the first book is back in print now.
Back in print, okay.
Fab Press have got it available again, yeah.
Fantastic. I'll have to grab that.
We'll promote that too, because that's kind of one of my... Because it was one of those times where I thought I knew everything, when I would buy all these VHS tapes, and then I come across the book, and I was like, shit, I'm not as smart as I thought I was. And, you know, what turned me on to the Nightmare USA was you featured two of my favorite films in there, which is The Severed Arm and House of the Dead, which is also known as Alien Zone, I believe, which is a really ridiculous title.
Yeah, I want to delve into that one more, actually.
So it turned me on to a few things. Actually, you know, Carnival of Blood, which we just discussed, it was one of those films that I really wanted to see for a long time. So I'm glad that Arrow did this, because this is substantial for their line. I mean, they're always rescuing films and putting out some. I mean, they're killing it with their lineup. But this is this one film that was pretty important, I would say, to get out there.
Brilliant. I'm glad. I had a, you know, it was a long process writing that book, but I had a great time doing it. And I'm really thrilled that people appreciated it so much. So,
blood of life. Close it.
Well, we hope you guys dug that interview or conversation with Stephen Thrower. Grab his book.
There's not really ever interviews. I always say interviews, like even scheduling.
Yeah.
And I think that throws everybody off, but it's kind of hard. Hey, do you want to have a discussion?
Yeah. We try
to
keep it light.
Like, I'm just saying it's weird contacting people because it's not really an interview, but a discussion sounds like, hey, you want to hang out?
You want to talk about your movie?
You like movies? I like movies too.
Let's just talk about movies, huh? All right, grab his book, Nightmare USA. It is out. It was reprinted, and I'm excited for his next his follow-up.
Nightmare USA is great.
And dude, I'm excited. And the Future of American Horror Project, man, that box set is amazing. You guys should get it before it sells out. I know that when I got mine, I got it through Amazon UK, and it was like $20 cheaper. So keep that in mind when you're ordering. Just be a little bit patient. Wait a couple weeks for it to arrive. Maybe three. You'll be fine. They always get to me. I don't think I've ever had an a UK order lost in the mail. I have had things from Florida lost in the mail.
I've sent you two things and they've been lost, right?
Yep, and Grindhouse Video sent me something and it has never been seen.
When did that happen?
With Bride of Reanimator. Fucking pissed. Somebody knew what was in it and basically stole it.
So, oh, dude, I got a screener the other day. It said right on the fucking box what it was.
I know.
Like on the package, and I was like, wait a second. Like, what if my mailman is a horror fanatic?
I know. I know. Basically, what we learned is, I think the one thing he sent me, he sent Bride of Reanimator media mail because I suggested it, trying to save a few bucks. So ultimately it's my fault. So I think media mail for sure, coming out my way, especially from Florida, something's fucked up with that. So priority 2 day all the way. Those never fail. All right. Enough about my mailing woes. I want to thank you guys for listening to the show. Next week we should I can't even talk. We should be returning with BJ Colangelo and Josh Obershaw, but we really wanted to get this episode just out to you guys. So look forward to that. Of course, check out all of our sponsors. Go to thescreamcast.com/sponsors and check all of them out. Vinegar Syndrome, Grindhouse Video, Coffee Shop of Horrors, Horror Pack,
Kevin Spencer.
Wolfman of Mars. Check all them out. Of course, if you buy anything from any of them, take a screenshot of your transaction, email it to us at readme@thescreamcast.com. We'll enter you into the next drawing for coffee and a mug and some other goodies. We're going to be doing a drawing for Sean's big box of porn.
Speaking of which, it's screencast-twister.
Oh,
or your 10% off
Vinegar Syndrome.
Your Vinegar Syndrome May pack.
Screamcast-twister. But we are going to be doing a Sean's box of porn drawing probably next month. So we need to think of something fun for that. We want when you enter, we want to know what you're entering for. You don't want a surprise box of porn showing up on your doorstep if that's not what you're into.
Yes.
But stay tuned, you know, keep your eyes peeled for that. We'll be tweeting out stuff like that as far as that goes, info. And we'll talk to all of you guys next week.
Is this debuting tomorrow?
Bye-bye.
Wait, is this debuting tomorrow?
Yeah.
All right, then we need to pimp out Vinegar Syndrome's free international shipping.
Oh, when are they doing that?
Tomorrow, only one day only.
One day only. Today, as you're listening to this, order from Vinegar Syndrome today.
Get it. Free international shipping sale from 12 a.m. to 11:59 p.m.
Damn. All right.
So your international people that listen to us, I know that we have quite a few listeners in the UK, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Here's your chance. Pick up Telephone Book, American Dreamer, Dolemite.
Same thing with our friends in Canada. Take advantage of that.
Oh, yeah, Canada, too.
Shipping to them is bullshit.
Yeah, because they lose money every time.
Ugh.
It's like 77, like the Canadian dollar is 77 cents over here now.
Yeah.
Like that.
We feel
that,
for you guys.
That hurts, man.
We really do. All right, and with that, you guys have a great week. Talk to you next time, or great weekend. Talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Oh, don't tell me you're leaving. The party's just begun.